Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, everyday heroes, we look at the lesser-known people who have shaped history. Then, what is the future of the United Nations in the face of Donald Trump as U.S. president? And first, how the heck did a team of scientists find seven Earth-like planets orbiting a dwarf star? With us is James Ingalls. He is a staff scientist at the Spitzer Space Telescope Science Center. He's a member of the Infrared Spectrograph Instrument Support Team that discovered the seven new terrestrial planets. He also co-authored Bleeding Afghanistan with Sonali Kohatkar. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jim Ingalls. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
You were involved in this project that ultimately discovered these seven planets.
There are seven confirmed signals of planets that are passing in front of the star, TRAPPIST-1.
So you're calling them signals, implying that is it possible that they're not really planets?
I guess that's kind of scientific speak for there's always the possibility that you're wrong. But as far as we know, there are signals that we are pretty sure are planets that it would be very hard to get them from something else. They're regular, they're repeatable, they come around again and again. And just for your listeners who may not be aware, the signal is a transit. So when you're looking at a star, and you can't actually image the star, you can't take a picture of the whole circle of the star, the sphere of the star. You're just looking at a dot of light because there's too far away. So you can't resolve the full star. But when a planet crosses in front of the star along your line of sight, it will diminish the amount of light that you measure, the total amount of light you measure from the star. That's when a planet is transiting the star, you see a drop in light. So we're seeing drops in the light that occur on regular intervals that can be identified or connected with seven planets.
Which is what's implying the orbit, of course.
Right.
The detail that sounded like we understand about these and the significance of this is what I really would like to get into. The way it was described in many of the media was that these are potentially Earth-like planets. And some of them have rocky surfaces. It looks like some of them could be habitable in some way or another.
So we can measure a few things by this transit signal. When the amount of light that gets blocked from the star tells you the size of the planet. Basically gives you a relative size of how big the planet is relative to the size of the star. So that gives you a good sense of how big they are. And all of them are very close to the size of the Earth. They're give or take maybe 10% of the size of the Earth. And at the same time, you can also measure the periods. So as a planet goes in front of its star and it's repeatable, you're seeing that it has a certain period. But those periods are actually varying by a little bit. And that varying is due to the fact that you've got more than one body that's orbiting the same star, and they're all tugging at each other gravitationally. And those tugs affect the timing of the transit, so it doesn't always happen at the same time. And those variations allow you to kind of separate the masses of those planets, so how much matter is in each planet. And when you take the size and the mass, you can get an approximate density. And that is when people say, okay, the density is very similar to this material, silicon or some other material. That's when scientists will say it's a rocky planet, because the densities are very close to that of the Earth, slightly below that of the Earth, but not much. So that implies that they're probably very rocky. They're probably a lot of dense material, they're not gaseous like Jupiter.
And then in terms of the temperature of the planet or the possibility of water being on the planets?
Well, the temperature is derived from the distance that we can gather from the planets to their stars, from to the star. And we know that the star is a particular kind of star that has a certain temperature, a certain brightness, a certain amount of radiation that comes out of it, heat that's emitted from the star that can heat a planet. And depending on the distance from the star the planet is, you can estimate what you think the temperature of the planet might be. And those temperatures that we're getting are in the range in our solar system that you would see ranging from, say, Mercury, which is really hot compared to the Earth, to Mars, which is a bit colder than the Earth. So we've got planets in between that, which are probably in a zone where you've got temperatures close to that of the Earth and where liquid water you know, water can stay in liquid form, and therefore they can be conducive to the formation of life as we know it.
So I read in the publication, I think it was Nature, that the star itself is what they would call a red dwarf star. What exactly is that?
It's a very low mass star. It's a very small, low mass star. It has a lot less material than the sun, probably about a little less than 10% of the mass of the sun. And so when you have that amount of material, the stars don't heat up quite as much as a star that has the mass of the sun. They heat up, their temperature, the surface temperature is about 3,000 degrees as opposed to about 6,000 degrees above absolute zero. And so, you know, about the half the temperature of the sun. So they're not as hot. They don't give off as much light, as much heat as the sun does. So the interesting thing is that this planetary system is very small. It's very tight. The orbits are tight. They're close to the star, a lot closer than the planets in our solar system are to the sun. And so the fact that they're closer, but that the star is cooler, means that the temperatures are very similar to what we get in the inner solar system. So it's a very, kind of a nice confluence of facts.
Another thing that was in that Nature article was that there were some assumptions before that had to be discarded.
When the system was first monitored to try to look for planets, the early observations were not done in a way, they were not capable of being done continuously where you're constantly looking at the light of the star to see how it varies with the planets crossing it. So you're catching it at intervals, and short intervals, and you're seeing drops in light from planets. You're not sure exactly how many planets there are and what their characteristics all are. So it was early on, the most that could have been said from, say, early in 2016, that was that there were at least three planets. That was the earliest idea. And that it was hard to say what that third planet was like, because they only measured maybe one transit from it or a couple of transits, and it wasn't as regular as they thought it should be. And so people were confused about what it really meant. It really took a lot more observations. And then finally, in the fall of last year, the Spitzer Space Telescope was able to stare at that star for 20 days straight. So basically about 500 hours, almost continuously. There were drops when they had breaks where they had to downlink the data to the Earth as a space telescope. So almost 20 days straight. And that 20 days straight of looking at the dips as they happened enabled the team to really analyze the data and tease out the fact that there were seven planets there, that the signal that looked like it was coming from a third planet was really more than three.
Because they're so close together, they were crossing at a similar time.
Yeah, there were times when you had more than one planet at the same time. So you see a really complicated dip. It wasn't just a single dip. It was like kind of came down and up and then back down again. And it was because a couple were passing in front of the star at the same time. But it was hard to tell what the source of that drop dip was. So until they were able to look at it many, many times, then you're able to kind of tease it apart. And we're not sure on the outer planet. The seventh planet was discovered with the Spitzer measurements. And we only have one transit of that planet. So we're not actually sure what its period is. We don't know when it will come around again. So we're taking a lot of time to try to find that as well, trying to narrow that one down.
This is so far away. How can we, non-physicists or astronomers, understand truly the distance between where we are and where these planets are?
Well, it's about 40 light years away. So it's as far away as it takes a ray of light to travel in 40 years, which is pretty far. It would take, you know, hundreds of thousands of years to travel by, you know, rocket ship, the rockets that we have. As stars go, it's very close. I mean, it's in our neighborhood because our galaxy is thousands of light years across. But yeah, it's still pretty far by human standards.
And so what's next in this study? What is your team going to be doing?
Well, there's a lot of different kind of avenues that the team is working on. I'm just a part of it. I work at the Spitzer Space Telescope, Spitzer Science Center. So I'm more involved with the Spitzer side of things, which will be continuing to monitor to try to nail down the masses of the planets by measuring those timing variations more precisely. Because right now they're a little imprecise values, and we need to really nail those down. So that's what Spitzer is going to be focusing on. Also finding the period of the seventh planet, perhaps discovering more planets if there are any. And other avenues are going to be the study of the atmospheres of those planets using other observatories where they can measure, so they can break the light up into its constituent parts as a spectrum and see what the pieces of that, the light coming from the planets is composed of. And so that will be done with, some work has already been done with the Hubble Space Telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, which hasn't launched yet, but which will launch in 2019, will probably most likely target these planets. So really kind of figuring out if they have an atmosphere, that would be an interesting piece of information, what the composition of the atmosphere is. For example, if they find ozone in the atmosphere, it will be a very, very crucial piece of information, a very, you know, watershed event to find something that it's very hard to produce without life in the planet.
So if in fact they do find that,
biosignatures,
that would imply that there could be other life on these planets.
Right, that there could be life. Yeah, exactly.
Jim Ingalls, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for having me.
James Ingalls is a staff scientist at the Spitzer Space Telescope Science Center. He's a member of the Infrared Spectrograph Instrument Support Team that discovered the seven new terrestrial planets. We know the role of presidents and other leaders in shaping history, but we hear little about the unsung heroes, many who have risked their lives to liberate and rescue others. Who might some of those secret heroes be? We're joined by Paul Martin, journalist, editor, and author of Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. Welcome, Paul Martin. Often thousands are forgotten for the good they've done in making societies better, and you pulled a few out and wrote about them in your book.
That's right. I've always had a lifelong fascination with unsung heroes. I've kept a file for years on these characters when I come across them in my reading or see something on television. When I decided to do a book, I tried to pull out 30 of the most interesting, offering a really broad range of time periods and backgrounds, occupations, and so forth. And the mix that I have is just filled with people that ought to be better known. I mean, there's Hercules Mulligan, who is a tailor in New York City during the Revolutionary War, and he was recruited as a spy. And on two occasions, since he had British officers as customers, he learned about plots to waylay General Washington and was able to warn him and very possibly save his life.
Wasn't his brother also involved?
Was also involved. In fact, his brother was a conduit for another outstanding thing that Mulligan did, and that is he literally converted Alexander Hamilton to the American cause. Hamilton was born in the Caribbean, and he had grown up. He was a loyal British subject. And when he came to study in New York, he went to King's College, which is today's Columbia University, and he needed a place to stay, and he contacted Hercules Mulligan's brother, who referred him on to Hercules, and Alexander Hamilton stayed with Mulligan, and through the course of evening's conversations with Mulligan and his friends, Hamilton was won over to the American cause and became, you know, a real leader.
One of the characters that I thought was most interesting and that I hadn't known as much about as I would have liked to was Mary Elizabeth Bowser, who played a huge role in the Civil War. Tell us about her and her impact on the Civil War.
She was born a slave in Richmond, Virginia. Her master was a hardware merchant in Richmond, and he actually sold off Bowser's family, her mother and father and brother and sister. His name was John Van Loo, and when he died, his daughter, Elizabeth Van Loo, bought back Bowser's family and gave them all their freedom. And Elizabeth Van Loo sent Mary Bowser to Philadelphia to be educated. Bowser came back to Richmond just as the Civil War was starting, and when the Civil War began, Elizabeth Van Loo formed a spy ring for the Union. She recruited Mary Bowser because she was a rarity. She was a former slave, an African-American who was educated, could read and write, which was obviously a rarity at that time. And Van Loo was able to place her in the White House of the Confederacy, the home of Jefferson Davis and his wife and children. Bowser was a family servant, and she took care of Jefferson Davis's children and served meals, cleaned up afterwards. Well, as far as Davis knew, she was an illiterate slave, and he and his officers spoke openly in front of her. She also had a photographic memory, and Davis would leave his papers strewn around on his desk, and she could just, at a glance, pick up all sorts of information about Southern troop movements and finances and so forth. She relayed those on to the Union. She was recognized in 1995 as one of the most important spies for the Union cause during the Civil War.
How was she able to convey that information?
There were some fascinating ways they would hide messages in like a basket full of eggs. They would hollow out one of the eggs and put messages inside the egg. And another way was they would put it in the shoes of a slave, and the Southerners were disdainful and wouldn't, you know, want to have anything to do with the slaves and their clothing, and so they were able to get things past the Southern soldiers. So it was an amazing display of bravery for 2 years to be by herself, right, as I said, in the lion's den. It turned out that she discovered so many secrets that they began to suspect that there was a mole somewhere in the White House of the Confederacy, and so she fled. She was there for 2 years, and her last act was she tried to burn down the White House of the Confederacy. She wasn't successful, but she fled in 1864 and was never heard of again. She disappeared from history.
There were three other women that I thought were particularly interesting in your book. Anne Royal was one. Grace Abbott, and Inez Boisevain.
Yes, all three of those I'd never heard of. And in fact, I could say I think all but one or two of the characters in my book I'd never heard of, and I wasn't familiar with even the ones that I had heard of. For instance, Hedy Lamarr, I didn't know that the achievements she did that were totally unknown to the public. But the three persons that you mentioned, Anne Royal was just this fabulous character. She was born on the frontier and survived Indian attacks, and she ended up marrying an older man who was quite wealthy. And when he died, she traveled around a bit, and she was well-to-do. But then her husband's family overturned the will, and she was left absolutely penniless at the age of 54. So she decided she'd become a writer, and she started writing travel books, and she wrote one novel. She lived hand-to-mouth the whole time. And then she went to Washington, D.C., and when she was in her 60s, she began a newspaper. And she was a terror. She was the first muckraker in American journalism. And she would traipse around the halls of Congress and government offices and just buttonhole officials and grill them. She would print everything, you know, she found, and she had very strong opinions. She was adamantly for the separation of church and state, and she was just a holy terror.
I think you mentioned that people still study her in journalism schools.
They do. She's regarded as the first of the muckrakers. She's really the first investigative journalist in early history of journalism. Journalism often was advertised in her PR almost, and she really dug for the truth and was fearless. And she made so many enemies that the U.S. Post Office stopped delivering her newspaper because she made so many enemies on Capitol Hill. So she started a second newspaper and delivered it on her own. And of course, she never had a very wide circulation or never made any money. In fact, she died, I think she had a total of 6 cents when she died. But her influence was tremendous.
And then the other two really interesting women, Grace Abbott and Inez Boisevain, had to have a little bit more of a similar impact.
Grace Abbott is just someone that you'd never hear of, and the woman was absolutely amazing. She grew up in Nebraska and was trained as a teacher, and she went to Chicago and studied at the University of Chicago, and then she became involved in protecting immigrants. And for 9 years, she ran the Immigrant Protective League. And then she was recruited to the U.S. Children's Bureau, which at that time was a federal office to overlook the rights of the interests of children. And she improved the lives of millions of people through information she distributed on maternal health care and infant health care. Even then, and still today, the infant mortality rate in this country is really shocking. We have 4 times the infant mortality rate of Japan today. And she did so much to protect the children. The other thing she did was she was instrumental in writing the child labor provisions of the Social Security Act. And she also wrote child labor provisions in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was passed in 1938. Unbelievably, there was still exploitative child labor up to 1938, but afterwards, when that law was passed, we finally ended that shameful period of our history. The other person you mentioned, Inez Beausevain, she was a colorful character. She was one of the few characters in the book who grew up in a wealthy family. And she had a privileged upbringing. She went to Vassar College, but she was a real rebel, and she was in the forefront of the women's suffrage movement, and she made speeches on campus, and as I said in the book, I think the people at Vassar probably threw themselves a party when she finally graduated. But she went on to New York, and she got a law degree at New York University, and one of the first things she did was investigate the horrible prison conditions at Sing Sing. And she wrote a report, and it resulted in widespread reforms. And she literally gave her life for the cause. She was speaking in the western half of the United States, trying to get passage of universal women's suffrage. And she collapsed on stage in Los Angeles, and it turned out she had pernicious anemia, which today is very treatable, but back then it wasn't. And she ended up dying, and so she was a martyr to her cause.
Yeah, only 30 years old.
Exactly. And they told her if she cut back and, you know, stopped exerting herself, she could probably weather this health issue, but she refused to. She literally gave her life for the cause.
And then if we were to move up in time, there are two other people. They're very different. One was Golden Rule Jones, who was very interesting, and the other was Kirk Bloodsworth.
Golden Rule Jones, of course, was a progressive leader during the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century. He grew up poor, and he got into the oil business, and he started his own company and made a fortune. He moved to Ohio and started Ohio Oil, which was bought out by Standard Oil, and so he became quite wealthy. But he had a tragedy in his life. His wife and one of his children passed away. He remarried, and his second wife lived in Toledo. So he moved to Toledo, and he started a company to produce oil drilling equipment. It had the memorable name of the Acme Sucker Rod Company. And he was 50 years ahead of his time. He instituted an 8-hour workday. He refused to use child labor. I mean, this was all before, while these things were going on, he was doing these things on his own. He gave Christmas bonuses, paid vacations. He built a park and playground for his employees. And his whole point of view was that everyone should live by the Golden Rule. I mean, it was very simple, and that's the way he treated his employees, and they responded with incredible loyalty. Well, he became famous for this, and they started around Toledo, started calling him Golden Rule Jones. And then he was put up for election by the Republicans and for mayor of Toledo, and he won. And the amazing thing was that when he started introducing the same kinds of reforms that he'd done in his company to city government, the Republicans were up in arms. Business interests, they thought, you know, that this was not the way to go. So the next election for mayor, they kicked him to the side, and he ran as an independent, and he won with 70% of the vote, and he was reelected three other times. He died in office when he was 54, but he was a real progressive, and he was one of the people who brought us things that we accept today. Everyone thinks that a 40-hour work week and paid vacations are the right of all Americans, but if it wasn't for people like Samuel Jones, that just wouldn't have happened. The other person you mentioned, Kirk Bloodsworth, he's interesting for several reasons. One, he's the only living character of the 30 people I write about. He's still alive. He grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland. His family was, they were watermen. He grew up crabbing and oystering, helping his dad on his boat. And he joined the Marines, and after the Marines, he married a woman who lived in Essex, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore. And at the very time that he settled in Essex, a 9-year-old girl was brutally raped and murdered, and Kirk Bloodsworth was arrested for this. He had nothing to do with it. He was completely innocent. And he was convicted basically on the testimony of a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old who said they saw him. Well, he spent 9 years in prison. He was convicted and given the death sentence, and he was sent to prison in Baltimore, the state prison penitentiary. His death sentence was overturned. He was given 2 life terms. And to while away the time, I mean, to keep himself sane, he would read a lot in the prison library, and he happened to read a book about DNA profiling, which was perfected in 1984 by a professor in Leicester, England, and a light bulb went on, and Bloodsworth said, well, this could be used to prove I was not the killer. And it just happened that his attorney had asked that all the evidence in the case be saved, and it was sent to a lab in California and tested, and he was exonerated and set free after 9 years in prison. He was the first death row inmate to be set free by DNA testing in this country.
And then he went on and made it part of his cause.
He did. He was instrumental in getting the Innocent Protection Act and the testing portion of that act, which any convicted prisoner is tested for DNA now. Their DNA is recorded, and that test is named in Bloodsworth's honor.
Well, Paul Martin, thank you so much, and thank you for honoring the everyday Americans who shape our world. The book, again, is called Secret Heroes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
When we come back, what is the future of the United Nations in the face of Donald Trump as U.S. president? Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The United Nations is facing multiple stressors, but among the largest is the new president of the United States, Donald Trump, who has expressed hostility toward the organization. What does the future hold for the United Nations, and what does it mean for all of the programs that it sponsors? With us are two experts. Stephen Hoadley is a professor of politics and international relations at the University of Auckland. His books include Asian Security Reassessed, Singapore, Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, New Zealand and France, Politics, Diplomacy, and Dispute Management in Soldiers and Politics in Southeast Asia. Mark Amsler is also with us. He's director of the Europe Institute and a professor of cultures, languages, and linguistics. He's the author of Effective Literacies and Imagining Unthinkable Spaces. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. We want to understand what exactly we're facing, particularly over the next 4 years, but really beyond, with the United Nations and with Donald Trump election. But I thought we should start with a bit of a historic context to understand where we've come to at this point in time. Steve Hoadley, do you want to start?
Yes, Maria. We have to go back to the League of Nations debate in after World War One, when the Republican irreconcilables in the Senate were very skeptical about the United States joining at the behest of President Wilson, the then League of Nations. And the upshot of this long debate was that the League of Nations treaty could not be passed by a two-thirds majority. Consequently, the United States stayed out. This allowed then the paralysis of the League of Nations, underfunding, and the rise of the aggressors in Germany, Italy, and Japan. Now, this is a profound lesson that Franklin Roosevelt learned during his time as Secretary of the Navy and then his period in the wilderness, and then eventually his rise to the presidency in 1932. And he undertook in the late 1930s a determined campaign to bring around first the American people, and then the Republican Party, represented by the senator from Michigan, Vandenberg, who was a skeptic and then was persuaded to back the United Nations by 1943. And in 1945, eventually, the UN was founded as the charter was approved. But the point that I think needs to be made when you look at the history of the UN is this undercurrent of American skepticism that the Constitution is second to none. No international organization can trump, no pun intended, the Constitution, that the United States is sovereign and international organization, certainly very useful. But the feeling is that any organization that countered U.S. interests was looked at with some suspicion, particularly by Republicans, as shown by polls, particularly by people of lower educational achievement and certain parts of the country. what those parts that voted for Donald Trump in the last election. So there has been, through public opinion polls, a general feeling in the public that a slight majority have favored the UN, although the approval has gone up and down with various events. But there has been a divide within the American public that appears now to be exacerbated by the Trump phenomenon, so that what was difference of opinion is now deep polarization. I think if you went to Democratic voters, those who would vote for Hillary Clinton, for example, you'd find a clear majority saying that the UN is useful, it performs a great function. And I'm sure that Mark and you and I will talk about this later, what does the UN do for the U.S.? But it's a political divide between the Republicans, people of lower socioeconomic status, lower educational achievement, that are now providing the uplift for the Trump presidency. So I think we have to recognize that, as I said the other day, there are two Americas, and one is the Trump America, and the other is, well, I think what we would all agree, a more sensible America that is more committed to international stability and continuity.
It seems to me that despite the divide and the skepticism, particularly among Republicans that you note, it seems like historically there's been more bluster among Republican presidents, but still continuing legitimate support for the United Nations and its projects in recognition of what the United States gets out of it. Would say a bit about that and if that's even an accurate assessment.
No president up to now has talked about expelling the United Nations from its headquarters at Turtle Island in Manhattan. No president has cut off the principal funding sources. No president has ever criticized, except John Bolton under the Bush presidency, the UN in a direct way, because they all recognize that the UN performs many services. The Trump utterances recently are almost without precedent. Now, it is true that President Clinton did reduce funding for peacekeeping. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, peacekeeping proliferated. The Black Hawk Down, Mogadishu syndrome set in, and there was a great disillusionment, particularly amongst Republicans. And the Republicans in the Senate, led by Jesse Helms, were able to force a reduction of the peacekeeping budget. The United States fell into arrears and was highly criticized for not bearing its fair share. The United States did renegotiate with the UN to reduce the assessment more in proportion with its proportion of the GDP in the world economy, and fair enough. The UN undertook many reforms to reduce bureaucracy, to improve costs, took on board an American accountancy firm to conduct efficiency surveys amongst the secretariat. And all of these reforms were made at the behest of the U.S. They were all carried out. And then Jesse Helms was actually invited to address the U.N. General Assembly. And he turned right around like Vandenberg did in 1943. And the United States paid up all of its arrears. And things turned out in the 2000s much better. Now, of course, we may want to talk about John Bolton, for almost national security advisor, who was a rather strange choice for UN ambassador. But yeah, there was some skepticism. But the bottom line is that the U.S. presidency and the executive generally and the American people generally and even the Republicans grudgingly have acknowledged the fact that UN, as they say, if it didn't exist, we would have to invent it again.
Mark Amsler, what would you add?
One of the things about the United Nations is that it's fundamentally, right, a supranational organization. It's committed to the notion of, to the importance of multilateralism. And as the Cold War declined and then sort of disappeared or disintegrated in various ways, the bipolar relationship became a unipolar relationship. But since that time, and with the changes that occurred in the 1990s in the United States with relationship to the UN, then there has been this other rise, this new rise of a multipolar world with a resurgent Russia, China, the increasing sort of presence as a global actor in the of the European Union and so forth. So the unipolar world of the U.S. and then everybody else has been shifting quite dramatically, I would say, in the last 15 years or so. That said, then, the United States has always had, as Steve was pointing out, this problem with the multilateralism and the internationalism of the United Nations, because you can't have a policy of America first on the one hand. And as people point out, all presidents have had that policy. It's not unique to Donald Trump. But that if you have a policy of America first and the Constitution first, where does the United Nations fit into that? Is it their plaything? Is it their avenue for foreign aid and policymaking? Or is it something that goes alongside of and actually brings the United States into the world in a more general forum? And I think that's really what an interesting point. Too often in the discussion about the United Nations, the range of activities that the UN does and is involved in and has been involved in gets reduced to something like peacekeeping and policing. Never mind health and education, never mind hunger and poverty, never mind social development across the board, no mind human rights, no mind changing the inequities among genders and sexuality, the support for women's reproductive rights, tons of things, right? The Declaration of Human Rights, courtesy of Eleanor Roosevelt and company, is still a fundamental document for any socially progressive movement in the world. They appeal to the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. Malcolm X, for heaven's sake, one of the things that was happening in the mid-60s was that Malcolm wanted to take the civil rights struggle in the United States onto the international stage, connect it to international decolonization movements. He wanted to do so specifically by invoking the Declaration of Human Rights. So that's part of the ongoing legacy, and also the momentum of the United Nations beyond peacekeeping and money-sucking as a bureaucracy. And it does get a bad rap. I shouldn't say that. Steve's right. It's reformed itself, and it still has the bad rap of being a money-sucking bureaucracy, just like the EU is the same way. These are massive, you know, supranational institutions that are extraordinarily well-funded. The budget, I think, this year for they run on a two-year cycle for the UN is about 5.678, something like that, 5.8 billion. The US, based on the GNP calculation and assessments, are roughly 21-22% of that. So the US has a fairly big economic stake in that. But it's not, in terms of assessment, it's not disproportionate to the size of the economies, right? So Germany pays 6%, France pays 6%, China pays 11 or 10%. All based on a single ratio assessment across the board. So nobody's being treated specially or unfairly according to the assessment rate. So given that, the U.S. should have and does have a pretty big say in what goes on. On the other hand, where else do you get 193, you know, individual nations participating in a collective decision making? Sometimes that can be really slow. I think the Balkan crisis and so forth was a good example in the 90s, and it really dragged on the Clinton administration, was a good example of the slowness and the cautiousness of an administrative agency like the United Nations, where NGOs have moved, you know, pretty quickly into a situation and been much more effective in the broad sense of the term, perhaps, than the United Nations has been. On the other hand, the United Nations is always there. They do the work. All nations contribute, and they do so for – and also with the allied groups, you know, the WHO, various kinds of these, the Program for Economic and Social Development, which New Zealand has had a big stake in, of course, and so on. So I think that in that respect, from my perspective, the multilateralism and the larger humanitarian, I just don't mean special aid, I mean larger, what is humanity up to and where are we going, role that the UN plays is really crucial. And frankly, the Trump administration, he's not the only one doing this, right? The Trump administration wants to basically pull the rug out from as much of that as they possibly can. And what we don't have, frankly, is a clear statement to this point of why and what they think the outcomes will be. Now, maybe next to tomorrow or tonight, we might learn a bit more about what that might be. I don't think so, frankly, because I don't think that they fully understand what the implications are. I think they have a rhetoric, a discourse of take away, get free, sovereignty, which was the discourse of the Brexiteers. They don't have a follow-up plan, which is what's driving Theresa May's government crazy. And I think it's going to be the same problem for Donald Trump's.
Steve Holley, what would you add?
The budgetary assessment of the UN is something on the order of 1/400th of the federal budget. And this is about 1/100th of the Pentagon's budget. So the part that Mark made, it's not a great burden on the American people. We're talking about a dollar or two per capita in the U.S. So any accusation that the UN is draining money in large amounts from the United States is simply wrong. The second point I think that should be impressed on the Trump people is all the things that the UN does that the United States would have to do by itself. But let's just start with the latest WHO discussion of penicillin-resistant bacteria. Now, WHO is conducting research. It's going to coordinate national research agencies on this, what could be a pandemic threat. Can the United States do it all by itself if the WHO is cut back in funding? What about World Food Program? Is the United States, are generous Americans going to stand by and let people starve in South Sudan or many other places without the World Food Program giving assistance? And what about peacekeeping? Are you going to link with the Russians and bomb volatile areas into submission? The peacekeeping, about something like 100,000 peacekeepers are deployed at the present time. Not a single one is American. This is something the UN does for the United States. The United States certainly provides a quarter of the budget, but it gets enormous benefit in social and political stability in faraway places. I'd like to make a special mention of the United Nations Human Rights Council because I teach this particular subject, and there is a move to remove the United States from the Human Rights Council. New Zealand, some years ago, when the United States was voted off of it because of President Bush's policies, New Zealand stood aside when it was its turn to bid for membership and encouraged the United States to come back to the table, which it did, and has performed a number of very useful functions. And one of these is to bring charges against President Rajapaksa in Sri Lanka for alleged violation of laws of war and near genocide. I think, reproductive rights, although this is a red flag to the Trump people, have been supported. The equality of women, the benefit of children, the resistance to child soldiers, human trafficking, all of those things have been supported. Now, certainly the United States has found the Human Rights Council flawed. They repeatedly pass resolutions condemning Israel and ignore the gross human rights violations of dozens of other countries, some of which have representatives on the Human Rights Council. So yes, and it was revised about a decade ago at the United States' insistence, and it's operating slightly better than its predecessor. But nevertheless, for the United States to withdraw entirely from that would be a signal that the United States doesn't take human rights seriously any longer, that it will allow human rights violations to take place. And this, of course, would rebound on the United States itself. As standards went down, then the human rights standards domestically would be affected by the erosion of international standards. Mark mentioned that Malcolm X brought the attention of the international community to United States discrimination against African Americans. That's exactly why Trump wants to abolish the UN or cut it way back, because he is intolerant of criticism. A reasoned debate is beyond his capability, my way or the highway, and consequently, the robust debate that does take place in the UN, in the General Assembly, in the Security Council, in various councils and commissions, are intolerant. Now, this is not a very good look. I think we would all agree it would violate what we think are good academic principles of honest debate amongst people who honestly disagree but are willing to put their facts on the table and argue from logic, and that it makes the United States look somewhat petulant and juvenile, as one commentator put it, that unable to carry on a rational dialogue in these international fora. So that it's a very disappointing development.
Mark Amsler, you had mentioned earlier that Trump is not the only force that is really whittling away at the United Nations' ability to continue doing this, all of these services that it provides. Of course, that administration is particularly hostile even to the aims that you were describing that we're all speaking in high terms of. From the European perspective, how do you see this?
The comparison between the United Nations and the European Union, both in terms of structure and in terms of social position and as actors on the global scale, is an interesting one. They're not the same, right? But they raise some really interesting and comparable issues. Just as Trump trashes the United Nations in many ways, he trashes the EU. and I think for the same reasons. One of the things about the European Union is, after June 23rd last year and the success of the Brexit referendum, is a strengthening and a kind of amplification of the critical voice or the voice of sovereignty in Europe, that we want our borders back. We want our country back. We don't want the European Union and those unelected officials and bureaucrats in Brussels and Geneva and so forth to be telling us what to do and setting rules and regulations and standards and punishing us with taking funds from our national treasuries and using it for all of this administrative apparatus and so forth and so on. It's a very similar kind of discourse, right, in that respect. And similarly, as I was talking about some of the ways in which the UN stands for or has stood for what I think of as admirable and aspirational goals, not only economic and political, but also social, humanitarian, and ethical, so too the EU has a set of aspirational goals and a set of standards which are confirmed by things about human rights, about the non-discrimination of anyone in the EU, that is to say an EU citizen, a category of person that didn't exist before there was a European Union, no discrimination on the basis of language, religion, sex, gender. They make that distinction, which is kind of interesting, or race. The point is that there's a number of aspects of the EU's aspiration for human rights, for non-discrimination, for economic and social equality, and so forth and so on, which are quite consonant with the United Nations and with a whole number of what I would take to be progressive movements and positions worldwide. So the European Union has similar problems with its audience, so to speak, as the United Nations does, although maybe on a slightly smaller scale because it's a regional rather than fully international. But the same issue of multilateralism and a multipolar sense of power relationships operates. The rise of Russia has really challenged the enlargement program in Eastern Europe. Turkey still remains in that kind of never-never land of being in and out of Europe simultaneously, even as Putin, interestingly, is promoting the resurgent Russia as a Eurasian power. He wants to be a Eurasian power maker and player, not across borders and so forth and so on. So there's quite a complex set of relationships there. And likewise, compared with the United Nations, in the EU, there's the whole Germany and France and Italy, the three of the six founders of the European Union, and their central role in organizing and keeping focused the activities of all of the 28 member states. And likewise, there's this kind of inequity or this asymmetry in terms of financial contributions, but more importantly, the way in which the International Monetary Fund, which is interesting given its relationship to the United Nations, the way the IMF is operating as a kind of benchmark and proposes standards or criteria for resolving debt, sovereign debts and so forth and so on. So they have a number of internal issues in Europe which are somewhat different than the United Nations in that respect. But I think politically and in the larger framework of the political economy, there's some interesting comparisons. And the same, as I would say, the same discourse that won the day for the Brexiteers and may very well – is very, in fact, operating in the upcoming election on March 15th in the Netherlands, the French national election shortly, followed by the German national election. It's going to be quite a year in that respect. But these will all be bellwethers in the same way that the Trump election, however surprising people may have thought it was, nonetheless is a bellwether of this kind of discourse. And so watching what happens there, especially on March 15th in the Netherlands, will be an interesting test not only for what happens in the EU, but also what happens in other, you know, who gets fortified, who gets encouraged and so forth. And it's just a comment on that. The way these discourses work is also very interesting. I mean, Trump uses the same discourse as the anti-EU group, the Eurosceptics. It's no surprise that the Farage was literally standing in the wings, right, on election night in the United States. They were going back and forth. It was very much a transatlantic experience. Similarly, just today, I believe, the chief financial officer of JP Morgan just directly said, we think that the banking industry is in a position now where we need to pull back on the regulations. We need to go looser on the criteria for solvency and things like that. Things are better now. They're sustainable. It's rational. These are quotes. It's rational. It's normal. It feels right, right? And this is the same language, right, that was used in the Brexit vote, right, that this is the rational thing to do. The irrational people are the multinationalists. The rational people are the sovereigntists.
In the language.
In the discourse of Euroscepticism.
Yeah, distinguishing that you don't agree with that.
Oh, no, I don't. But I think it's important to understand who's talking and how. And you have to be able to somehow quote and think about the language that's being used.
And what it means.
And what it means. You know, everybody's having a field day with alternate facts, but it already has become a term, like just within a couple of months, already a term in the international discourses, not just in English. And the speed with which some of these ways of talking, which are consonant with ways of thinking or acting or being affected, A-F-F-E-C-T, are really striking in the new political environment. And I think that we're seeing that on both sides of the Atlantic, Europe and the United States. I think we're seeing it north and south as well. I think it's an international phenomenon.
Steve Hoadley.
Yes, with regard to the upcoming elections in Europe, I hope that sensible leaders will be pointing out the following. To the extent that the United States withdraws from active role internationally and in the UN, and to the extent that the European Union is weakened by the alt-right vote, what does that do to the international balance of power? What I fear it does, it hands the initiative to set the agenda to Russia on the one side and China on the other. Without a countervailing balance, we classical realists in the study of international relations would say the vacuum of power will be filled by the least scrupulous actors. So the United States, one would argue, is acting against its own interests. And if Trump can realize that to make America great again, America has to stay engaged, and he has to support the Europeans to remain engaged, because the alternative is to surrender the field of rivalry to less savory actors. We're talking about Putin. We're talking about Xi Jinping. And we're talking about others, the Iranians, for example, who might want to push into the arena. So from a purely rational point of view, Trump's proposals are counterproductive to what I believe he wants to achieve.
Mark Ansler.
I think that's right, Steve. And what I think of as an example of that is something going on right now. The United Nations has been instrumental in getting various sides in the Syrian civil war to sit down and talk to each other. Stefan de Mistura is the negotiator for the United Nations. He's an experienced negotiator. He's had a number of successes. He's got Assad's government and Russia and Iran on one side, and he's got the rebels and various supporters, Saudi Arabia, and various Arab countries, you know, specifically on the other side. And his pitch was very specifically, I ask you to work together. I know it's not going to be easy to end this horrible conflict and lay the foundation for a country at peace with itself, sovereign and unified. But the Syrian people desperately all want an end to this conflict, and you all know it. Interestingly, of course, no one in the room clapped when he made that declaration. But the point is, that's the UN. They're the only ones doing that. So if Russia, for example, were to move into an even stronger role than they have been able to attain in the last, say, 5 or 6 years in the Middle East, that kind of negotiation wouldn't be happening, for example. Similarly, China has its own, you know, they play a somewhat different game with their foreign policy and money and aid and so forth. But they would not be at all involved in that kind of a negotiation. They pretty much stay out of that kind of stuff as far as I can tell. So in a sense, that negotiation by the United Nations shows up to an extent the EU's inability to successfully come to terms with or be able to broker any kind of a deal or relationship that would alleviate their own self, you know, perceived problem of migration and border access and so forth and so on. However you feel about that particular crisis, you would think it would be in Europe's self-interest to be able to move in that direction. But they can't. They haven't. They haven't been able to. The UN has. And I find that an interesting study in contrast at this particular point. And as Steve said, that's all of that is in the United States' best interest. Not to see that, I think, is a big, big political blunder.
Returning to the Middle East again, the major actor is Iran at the moment, with potential to achieve nuclear weapons and missile delivery systems. Now, if that happens, two reactions will be set in motion. One is that Saudi Arabia, which is the chief rival of Iran, will also begin to explore the nuclear option. The Israelis already do have a nuclear option, and they may bring that, you know, make that more explicit. So without the restraining hand of either the EU or the United Nations, the United States is going to be forced to make some very difficult choices in an increasingly volatile and dangerous neighborhood. Shifting over to Asia, something similar is happening. Fortunately, Abe and Trump get along pretty well, so Trump has indicated he will continue to support U.S. troops being based in Japan. But if the Japanese were to feel that China was overshadowing their interests, the Japanese could probably go nuclear within 2 years. They've got the technology, they've got the money, they've got the know-how. And this, again, would complicate the balance of power. So what Trump wants to achieve is stability. He wants to achieve U.S. Prosperity through better trading relations, more advantageous to the United States. But without the U.S. geopolitical presence that has kept stability in the Asia-Pacific since World War II, and to some extent in Europe as well, now shared with the European Union, without that political stability, how can economies prosper? How can the world economy continue to provide more and more welfare to more and more people, that unprecedented in human history? So it seems to me that, again, the more sensible figures in Trump's cabinet, one sees the Secretary of Defense saying some fairly sensible things in contrast to Trump, and even his appointee as ambassador to the United Nations has indicated that she doesn't believe that funding should be cut. Let us hope that when Trump sits down with his advisors, he begins to listen rather than talk, and maybe, as one observer indicates, he may moderate after he has made his political points.
I want to thank both of you so much for this insightful discussion. So Mark Amsler, Steve Hoadley, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Thank you for hosting.
Stephen Hoadley is a professor of politics and international relations at the University of Auckland. His books include Asian Security Reassessed, Singapore Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, New Zealand and France, Politics, Diplomacy, and Dispute Management in Soldiers and Politics in Southeast Asia. Mark Amsler is director of the Europe Institute and a professor of cultures, languages, and linguistics. He's the author of Effective Literacies and Imagining Unthinkable Spaces. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.